This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Attorney General John Ashcroft got a big round of applause on the David Letterman show earlier this week when he sat in with the band at the piano and played the Beatles' Can't Buy Me Love. His approval rating is pretty high. Yet, as my guest Jeffrey Toobin writes, Ashcroft is the most polarizing figure in the Bush cabinet and the most socially conservative figure to become attorney general in many years. Toobin profiles Ashcroft in the current edition of The New Yorker. Toobin is a staff writer for the magazine and a legal analyst for ABC News. He writes about some of the controversial steps that Ashcroft has overseen in the war on terrorism, including the detention of more than 1,000 people on secret charges, the establishment of a new system for monitoring certain attorney-client conversations, and a plan to create military tribunals for alleged war criminals. But Toobin thinks that over time, Ashcroft's social agenda will be more controversial than his anti-terrorist measures. I asked why.
I think it's a combination of things. One is there is just such enormous support for anti-terrorism work across the political spectrum that just no one wants to take him on those issues. I mean, Democrats, you know, one of the things that I write about in this story is, you know, the Democrats got all worked up bringing him before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And once he got there, and this is last December, you know, they were meek as mice in front of him. I mean, this politically, all the advantage is on Ashcroft's side. Second, you know, I think in fairness to Ashcroft, some of these proposals have been somewhat distorted by their political adversaries. And they've moderated some of the proposals, particularly the military tribunals. When that proposal was first made, there was the possibility of death sentences on less than unanimous verdicts. There was no provision for an appeals process at all. Now, as the proposal has come out, those changes have been made. So I think there has been some responsiveness, not total responsiveness, to the concerns of civil libertarians.
And so you think he's going to be most controversial for which issues?
For his social agenda, for you know, the real fault lines of American politics. John Ashcroft, I mean, one of the fascinating things about going back over his long, long political career is to see that no issue has been more important to him than abortion. I mean, he is perhaps the most pro-life, prominent political person in the country. It has been the key issue to his whole political career. The only case he argued in the United States Supreme Court was his defense of a Missouri law that required all second trimester abortions to be conducted in hospitals. He actually lost that 6-3. But I think, you know, that is not an issue he's going to give up on. He's worked around the fringes of it, but I think that's where the real controversy is going to be. In addition, he has also been an extremely outspoken opponent of all sorts of gun control, and he's starting to bring that into the Justice Department, and I think there he may have some particular problems because it runs up against his anti-terrorism proposals in certain areas.
Well, in fact, didn't he refuse to let the FBI check to see if terrorists had purchased guns?
Well, that's the thing that really is so extraordinary and that I write about in this story is that, you know, the Brady Bill, which President Clinton signed in 1993, establishes what are called audit logs for almost all gun purchases in the United States. And what the FBI did in light of September 11th and these hundreds of arrests that they made, they started to check those audit logs, see if any of these potential terrorists bought guns. Ashcroft shut that process down. He said, you can't look at these records. According to my interpretation of the Brady Bill, which was explicitly contrary to Janet Reno's interpretation, you cannot check those. Those records have to be destroyed within 24 hours. They cannot be used for investigatory purposes. I mean, here you have potential evidence of gun purchases by people that Ashcroft believes are terrorists, and he says, no, you can't look at them. Again, that was a complete interpretation of the law in line with what the National Rifle Association had been saying all along. And Ashcroft, as a life member of the NRA, as a longtime believer in their principles, even in the crucible of a terrorist investigation, said, no, you can't look at those records. I think that's the kind of thing that will be controversial in the future.
I imagine that Ashcroft's fervent anti-abortion stand connects in some way to his religion. What about his opposition to anti-gun laws and his support of the NRA? Where does that fit into his constellation of beliefs? What backs that kind of strong pro-NRA stand?
Ashcroft is from Springfield, Missouri, which is in southern Missouri. It's in the Ozarks. It's very rural. It's almost southern in its orientation, more than Midwestern, like a lot of Missouri is. And Ashcroft, in many respects, his political philosophy comes out of the sort of southern post-war, culturally conservative, libertarian in certain respects, but certainly not all respects, politics that is very much taken over the Republican Party. The Republican Party is now a Southern and Western party where issues like gun control and abortion are really at the center of what people believe. And I don't think there's any religious basis for his position on gun control, but it is certainly strongly held in something that he's maintained for a long time.
As you point out, he's been accused of using his popularity from the anti-terrorism campaign to push his agenda on social issues like his opposition to gun control and his opposition to abortion. Did you come across any evidence that he's actually using his popularity now to push that social agenda?
Well, I think the most dramatic example of that comes in Oregon. Oregon passed what was called the Death with Dignity Act, which allowed, and I'm simplifying, some kinds of assisted suicide. And that has been a key tenet of the anti-abortion movement at the moment. Look, with Roe v. Wade on the books, there are only certain things there's only a limited amount that the pro-life movement can do on the issue of abortion. So they have adopted other issues, one of which is euthanasia, again, broadly defined. Ashcroft, in November, really at the peak of the terrorist investigation, reached out and said to Oregon, I am not going to let you enforce this. Again, contradicting or changing a policy of the Reno Justice Department because he views it as contrary to federal law. That was an example of him serving the pro-life constituency. Another example is people may remember that in a Nebraska statute was struck down by the Supreme Court, I believe 2 years ago, that banned what some people call partial birth abortion. The court said you couldn't ban partial birth abortion. Well, Ashcroft's Justice Department in Ohio went to court to say a slightly different partial birth abortion bill should be upheld in Ohio. You know, these are all issues at the fringes because that's really all you can do with Roe v. Wade around. But certainly he is going to fight for ways to advance what he's believed in his whole life.
You point out that Ashcroft's allies say that he's restoring the Justice Department's reputation, a reputation that was tarnished by Janet Reno. What do they think he's doing to restore the Justice Department's reputation?
Well, thinking back way, way back to the Clinton administration, Janet Reno was caught up literally for years in basically what was a single controversy, which was whether she should appoint an independent counsel to investigate Clinton and his administration on campaign finance reform. It sounds like it's from another century now, and it actually was, but it was just an endless hot controversy where Reno would be hauled before Congress, whether it was before Henry Hyde's committee or Orrin Hatch's committee, and just beaten up on that issue time after time. There is no similar controversy now. Now, I don't want to revisit the merits of that old controversy, but certainly there is not this sustained political attack on Ashcroft that there was on Reno, and I think Ashcroft is the beneficiary of that.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He profiles John Ashcroft in this week's edition of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Toobin is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. He has a profile of John Ashcroft in the current edition of The New Yorker. John Ashcroft is a very religious man, and his religion seems to also inform some of his political and social views. What church does he belong to?
He belongs to the Assemblies of God, which is part of the Pentecostal movement. It's actually it's fascinating. It's best known today for a rather unfortunate connection. It was the church of Jimmy Swaggart. It was the church of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. But it was actually it was only founded around the turn of the century when it was very much kind of a grassroots movement. It was racially diverse. It's no longer. It gave opportunities to women to be preachers in a way that many other denominations didn't. Amy Semple McPherson, who was a famous California minister, was part of the Assemblies of God. And Ashcroft literally grew up with that movement. His grandfather was an itinerant minister who really didn't even have his own church, who traveled around the country in a 1921 car, preaching on street corners. Ashcroft's father, Robert Ashcroft, was one of the people who brought the Assemblies of God closer to the religious and cultural mainstream. He founded or participated in founding three churches affiliated with the Assemblies of God in Springfield, Missouri, where Ashcroft grew up. So Ashcroft's life has been part of Assemblies of God remaining a little bit of a kind of outsider movement. I mean, it is an evangelical movement where people speak in tongues and things like that. But it has become much more mainstream, in part because of the efforts of people like his father.
Was John Ashcroft, the now Attorney General John Ashcroft, was he always religious?
Always religious. But interestingly, his father had one foot in the secular world. Robert Ashcroft, the Attorney General's father, tried to become a chaplain during World War II, and he was rejected because the Army had a requirement that you had to have a college degree. The Assemblies of God operated sort of independently of educational institutions in those early days, and he said, look, that's got to change. We've got to bring the Assemblies of God into the mainstream. We've got to go to have colleges that have serious academic requirements. We've got to, you know, preserve our religious affiliation, but also become part of the mainstream of American life. And he brought that philosophy to his son. Robert Ashcroft said, look, I'm going to have a very religious household, and they did. But John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, he always went to public schools, and he won a scholarship to Yale. And his father, even though Yale was a million miles away socially, politically, culturally from the Ashcroft world in Springfield, Missouri, he said, you go. You've got to be able to keep a foot in both worlds. And I think John Ashcroft's career has very much been in both worlds. He is a serious cultural conservative, but he's also a very accomplished politician.
After John Ashcroft graduated from Yale, he got a scholarship to Chicago Law School. Then he returned home to Springfield, Missouri, set up a law practice. How did he enter politics?
Well, he was a summer intern for his local congressman when he was at Yale, and the congressman retired soon after Ashcroft graduated from law school. And it's interesting, it's very much a replication of his father's career. His father brought the Assemblies of God to the educational world when the Assemblies of God had actually sort of shunned formal education. Ashcroft, in the early 70s, didn't know a single politician who was a member of Assemblies of God. There was also a kind of shunning of that process. But he said, look, we should join the political world as well. And he decided to run for Congress. He ran in a Republican primary in 1972, and he lost. But then in a weird, weird pattern that has held true for Ashcroft's entire career, his loss for Congress turned into a terrific victory for him, because instead of being a congressman, he was appointed state auditor of Missouri by then Governor Kit Bond, and so he became the fourth-ranking elected official in the whole state.
What was John Ashcroft's record as the governor of Missouri?
He had a record of considerable popularity. It was pretty good times in Missouri during that era, mostly in the 80s. And he, I think, was somewhat frustrated because his real issues that he's always cared about were the social issues like abortion, and there was only a limited amount he could do on those, and he was caught up in budgets and the kind of things that governors usually deal with. And I think he was very anxious to move on to different things after two terms as governor.
And he moved on to senator, U.S.
Senator. Well, there was another defeat in between. After his second term as governor, he ran for chairman of the Republican National Committee and lost. Had he won, who knows what would have happened. But because he lost, he was again at loose ends. And in 1994, John Danforth unexpectedly resigned from the Senate, opening up that seat. So for the third time in Ashcroft's career, when he lost for Congress, when he lost for state auditor, then when he lost for RNC chair, a defeat turned out to be a victory.
Ashcroft opposes gun control. He's a lifelong member of the NRA. How much backing over the years has he gotten from the NRA?
A lot. He during the 2000 Senate campaign, which was really an epic of modern politics, where he ran against Mel Carnahan, who was then the incumbent governor, the NRA contributed, I believe, $35,000 directly to his campaign, but also spent more than $300,000 on independent expenditures for Ashcroft. So he has been a strong favorite of the NRA, and he's repaid them in kind. Of course, this is the Senate race that ended in this extraordinary way. Mel Carnahan, the governor, was killed 3 weeks before Election Day in a plane crash, and Ashcroft then lost the election by 50,000 votes to Mel Carnahan's name was on the ballot, though the then governor said he was going to appoint Jean Carnahan, his widow, to the Senate, which he did.
This is another example of Ashcroft winning by losing.
Well, that was the fourth Congress, auditor, RNC chair, and then senator. And it's interesting, you know, when I asked him about these losses turning into victories, he kind of laughed about it and said, you know, my brother says about me, you're so lucky, if you fell into the sewer, you'd come out eating a ham sandwich. Well, I mean, that's pretty funny. But when he describes this experience to religious publications, as he has many times, he says over and over again the same thing. He says, you know, these defeats, they were crucifixions, and the victories, they were resurrections. Now, there are not many people in public life who would describe their own experiences as crucifixions and resurrections. But that is how John Ashcroft thinks. That's how he talks. And I think it's an interesting insight into his character.
What did you learn about his wishes for his political future and other people's plans for his political future?
Well, he told me that he was retired from politics. I asked him very explicitly, are you going to run for president in 2008? He said, oh, I'll be 66. I'll be too old. I said, come on, Ronald Reagan was older than that when he ran. And he looked at me and he said, I knew Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was a friend of mine. I'm no Ronald Reagan. Now, that was a pretty funny line. I have to give, you know, I give him credit for that. It was also a less than categorical denial of political interest. And, you know, as I talk to people in Washington, I think there is a growing sentiment that if Dick Cheney is unable to run for re-election for health purposes, Ashcroft would be a real possibility as his replacement. And I think if he were to get that, he would become, of course, the presumptive frontrunner in 2008. And, you know, I am far from the only person that has occurred to.
What's his popularity level now in the American public?
Well, it's really just extraordinary, Terry, when you think about it. I mean, here's a guy a year and a half ago who lost to a dead man. Almost a little more than a year ago, he was confirmed as Attorney General with 42 votes against him, the most ever against an Attorney General candidate. And here he is today with a 76% approval rating. You know, he's on David Letterman. He's speaking all over the country. No one's booing him. No one is when he appears in front of Congress, he gets very gentle treatment. It's been a remarkable political resurrection, to use his term.
You interviewed Ashcroft for your profile of him in The New Yorker. Is there anything that particularly surprised you about talking to him in person?
Yes, actually. You know, he presents a very forbidding presence in public, you know, when he's testifying or speaking. But in private, he's much lower key. He's very self-deprecating. He's actually has a very pleasant manner, which did surprise me. I mean, he's, you know, very homey. You know, I remember he said to me at one point, you know, there are only two things you need in life, duct tape and 10 WD and WD-40. You need WD-40 for things that are stuck together that need to come apart, and duct tape for things that are apart that need to come together. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that means, but it was kind of appealing, you know?
You have to hang out at hardware stores a lot to get that.
Exactly, yeah. You know, this is showing that Missouri thing. I remember There was an appearance he did not too long ago with Ed McMahon, who was sponsoring some Neighborhood Watch commercials. And Ed McMahon introduced him, of course, when you think about it, as "Here's Johnny," which is not exactly what you think about with John Ashcroft. And then Ashcroft said, "Gosh, we used to watch you every night at 10:30. And I thought to myself, gosh, he's such a Midwesterner. You know, those of us on the East Coast always thought of Johnny Carson on at 11:30. But by golly, he was on at 10:30 in St. Louis, and that's what John Ashcroft was going to say.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Always a pleasure.
Jeffrey Toobin's profile of John Ashcroft is published in this week's edition of The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.